Shall we get started then? So, hello. Thanks for coming along to this session. Floods and forest fires, living the climate crisis, which has been organised by the Labour Energy Forum. I'm Tom Gann. I'm going to be chairing this. I'm the general editor of New Socialist. To start off, we thought it might be interesting and useful, actually, if people very quickly, maybe for a couple of minutes, wanted to talk to their neighbours about how they felt about climate change. I think it's kind of quite important, actually, to kind of like sort of explore what feelings people have about climate change, how these can be like kind of both a limit on action and also a spur to it. So I don't know if people fancy doing that for like a couple of minutes. Okay. Questions: how people's feelings are kind of caught up in like in climate change, basically. So. What we're going to do, I'm just going to very quickly introduce the session and the panellists. Then we're going to have each panellist talk for about 10 minutes and then kind of open it up to kind of questions and thoughts, if that's okay. So you might remember this summer was quite hot, and obviously not just here. I mean, I think, you know, the climate is a planetary phenomenon. It was hot across the planet. And I mean, climate change is part of how capitalism organises nature. I think we can see this in like kind of increased engagements with concepts like the Anthropocene and the Capitalocene. And we've got Simon Lewis here, who's Professor of Global Climate Change Science at UCL and is co-author of a book, The Human Planet, How We Created the Anthropocene, to kind of talk about some of these themes. I think with this, although climate change is clearly caused kind of generically by humans, the other side of this is that the people who are most responsible, the people who've benefited most from the relations, the kinds of production that are causing climate change, are also the ones who are most insulated from its consequences. You know, the effects of climate change and the causes are extremely differentiated by geographic location, by class, by race, and by gender. So I think one of the themes we want to look at here quite a lot is how we think about colonialism as climate change, or climate change as colonialism. And I think Anna Markova, who's a campaigner with Platform, which is a London-based organisation working to build energy democracy, dismantle fossil fuels, and uplift marginalised voices, is going to talk about this a bit in her talk. And I think questions around colonialism also potentially open up some questions about how we think about the labour movement in a country like Britain that, on a global level, benefits massively from the relations that cause climate change. How do we think and how do we act with a labour movement that is both required to protect workers' jobs and conditions, but at the same time has a kind of global duty around climate change and around international solidarity. And I'm kind of very happy to have Tahir Latif, who's a member of the PCS National Executive Committee and working in aviation, who can hopefully talk about some stuff about how does the labour movement exist within climate change as a colonial phenomenon. And finally, any struggle against climate change is going to have to include moments of kind of local direct action, and we need to think here: how do we link this? How do we block stuff locally, but also how do we link this up to national policy, particularly if we have a chance of a left-leaning Labour government very soon? And how do we think about building international solidarity? And we've got Lou Castro, who's an anti-fracker, who's going to talk about struggles against fracking. So, yeah, to kick off, I think we'll have Simon. Thank you.
Is that loud enough? Thank you very much. So I'd like to thank the Labour Energy Forum for inviting me to speak. So there have been sort of two events in the summer and then one ending the summer relating to climate change. There have been really important moments. And the first was alluded to before, and that's the heat wave that happened over the summer and killed hundreds of people through this extreme heat. So the climate system has always produced cool periods and warm periods. But we have this long-term increasing temperatures, so global mean surface temperatures, about 1 degree warmer than they were in pre-industrial times. And that's adding heat to that, so when you get these heat waves, they're stronger than they were. And this has kind of been a wake-up call to say, actually, what humans do really matters, and it really matters to our everyday lives and the fabric of our everyday lives. And then on top of that, there was a second event. And a group of scientists produced a scientific paper suggesting that current emissions trajectories, even if we control climate change pretty well, could push Earth into a new hothouse state of 5 degrees warmer over the coming centuries. And the mechanisms by that are a series of tipping points. You raise the temperature enough that you have melting of the permafrost, which releases powerful greenhouse gas methane into the atmosphere. That causes enough warming to tip over another tipping point, the dieback of part of the Amazon rainforest, which leads to further emissions of CO2 into the atmosphere, and then an onwards kind of cascade of catastrophe, all of Earth's ecosystems reorganizing and the temperatures getting warmer. So that also kind of shocked everyone. It's front page news across the globe. And it's important to say some things about that in terms of how realistic it is. Now, it's certain that we're going to transform the Earth this century, even if we control climate change strongly and keep below 2 degrees C warm. But to run it and see the Earth go to 5 degrees and essentially unlivable conditions for kind of complex civilization, that's a low probability event. It's fairly unlikely in terms of the scientific models that have been run. But it's important to understand that we will only run the Earth system once. So on average, we might think that it's going to be 2 degrees, we'll keep it at 2 degrees, it might not push us to 3 or 4. But we will only do this experiment with the whole world one time. And, you know, my kid and everyone else's kids will have to live with the consequences. So it's all hands on deck in terms of dealing with emissions to reduce those probabilities. And in terms of dealing with climate change, there are all sorts of complex policies required, but the stand back message is that we need to go to zero emissions. So the warming is correlated with the cumulative emissions of carbon dioxide and then the other smaller greenhouse gases. And to get the climate to be stationary again, emissions need to reduce to zero. So that's a huge challenge to everyone, to all of society around the world, to get emissions to zero as fast as possible.
Yeah.
And at the moment, we're in a difficult phase globally. So we had the Paris Agreement at the very end of 2015, which the architecture was very cleverly organized and was lots of people are critical of it. It's a good international agreement to allow emissions to peak and then decline. And now we have the rise of right-wing populists and Trump saying he's going to pull out of the Paris Agreement. And this is giving cover to other countries to start pulling out of the limited agreements that they've already signed up to. So Australia is also one of the key candidates in the Brazil elections, saying that they would also pull out if they got in. So actually that multilateral framework is kind of being slowly pulled apart by Trump and the rise of the right-wing populists. And they're really dangerous politically, but they're really dangerous for the climate because they thrive on climate chaos. Because fear drives people towards the right, and they're not going to deal with the root causes of climate change, the emissions, and therefore that cycle benefits them. So, confronting Trump, Boris Johnson, you know, the other right-wing populists is really kind of essentially this kind of critical moment. I think the other thing that Heatwave tells us is that we're going towards, you know, if the world does a really brilliant job in tackling climate change, we will keep emissions, we will keep temperatures below 2 degrees C above pre-industrial levels. If we do pull out all the stops, and that still means a huge amount of destructive climate change. And that's going to hit the world's poor, whether it's in this country or abroad, because they have it much more vulnerable to changes than rich people who have insurance and will just move somewhere else. So, I forgot my phrase. The other big thing that the heat wave showed is that adaptation is incredibly important. And not only would you need to get emissions down as fast as possible to zero by the mid-century, but then we also need to adapt to the climate change that's coming. Because we're already living in the future now. We've seen that from the heat wave. 30 years ago, climate scientists said, this is what's going to happen. And it's happening. Exactly like people like Jim Hansen said to the US Congress 30 years ago this summer. And we would have heat waves, we would have destructive hurricanes, and we would have other destructive weather events. And in terms of the poor, I think it's under-recognized how big the kind of impacts are going to be through the food supply system. So we currently have about 7.5 billion people on Earth, and all require food from a big global complex agricultural system of food growing and trade. And people who are income poor spend the majority of their income on food, and climate impacts can raise food prices. And those food prices have massive impacts in terms of nutrition and also in terms of social unrest for people who are income poor. So that, I think that's under-recognized about how quickly things can move to a much more volatile situation with high food prices, migration across borders to escape climate impact and to deal with and to seek out a better life. And that these things can really then shift politics again towards the right if we're not careful. So really, I think climate change needs to be seen as central to a series of policies from the left to move from where we are towards a green future, because actually radical change is coming whether we like it or not, and we are going to transform Earth even if we pursue strong climate policies, because 2 degrees is Earth transforming. So we need to make sure that we get those emissions down towards zero. And in a practical context, that means that, you know, stopping all fracking in terms of policies in the UK, Heathrow expansion would need to be stopped, and then a series of policies to get emissions down to zero and shift our adaptation in terms of particularly cities, that we're going to, in summers, we're going to live in a more Mediterranean-type climate. And our cities are just not built for that kind of climate. And our policies for rural policies are also not built for that kind of rapid climate change. So we saw Indonesian forest fires on the uplands of moorlands in the north of England. And different management practices are really required to deal with that threat of fire when we have these super high temperatures, which are going to continue into the future, even if we manage climate change really well. And I think that the last point I'll make in the kind of big picture is that climate change is really scary. And what's required in terms of people engaging people like this is to have a much more positive visions of a kind of green future and how that might look. So it has to tackle work and production in the economy as well as the things we typically think of as green. And I think that one of those things is a universal basic income for everyone, which will allow people to kind of take themselves away slowly from having to do labour that's environmentally damaging, because they'll have many more choices, and will break that link between the production, as in you must go to work and work harder every year to get your income, and the consumption that goes with that, and the environmental problems that come with that mass-scale consumption. So we need to think about policies across the board, not just, quote, environmental policies that move us towards zero emissions and give us all better lives into the future. Thank you very much. My name is Tahir Tweef. I'm from the Public and Commercial Services Union, PCS. I'm the National Executive, and I'm also, for my seniors, the President of the Aviation Group in PCS, representing about 2,000 workers in aviation. And that's basically what I want to talk about for the next few minutes. Slight deviation from floods and forest fires, but I think still of relevance.
Yes,
sure. Thank you.
Always think, yeah, it'll be too loud if I do that, but if that's okay.
Yeah.
I want to thank the Labour Energy Forum for inviting me to speak. I'm very honoured to have been asked. And thank you, so many people, for turning up and taking the time to come and listen. So, I work in aviation, and you will know, I'm sure, that aviation is one of the most ruthlessly profiteering, profit-driven industries that we have. I mean, it's classic example of just trying to squeeze every penny out of the general public that it can. You know, if you've ever booked tickets for a flight, you'll know that it rapidly fluctuates up and down, and that's because they're trying to get the absolute maximum on every single seat, and that's kind of symptomatic of how the whole industry behaves, unfortunately. It is one, there's no two ways around it, it's one of the most greedy industries there is. And certain airlines really epitomise that. I don't think I can name any names particularly. Now, one of the things about that, level of greed, is the degree to which the aviation industry wants to grow, despite the fact of all the evidence of the damage that it's doing environmentally in terms of climate change. Now, I don't know. Let's see. The figures are, at the moment, there's about, in the UK, over the UK, there's just over 2 million flights a year. The industry itself wants to grow that to over 3 million by 2030. And in fact, it wants to double it by 2050. And I think actually across Europe, there's an aspiration, as if that's a good thing, to double the amount of flights over Europe by 2050, which coincidentally happens to be when we have to meet that Paris Agreement climate target. So that's what they want to do, is to grow the amount of flying that they're doing. And you know, don't have to be a genius to work out the amount of damage that would do if we just allow that to happen unchecked. To me, it's almost like a textbook definition of insanity, really, given the circumstances that have just been described about the way the planet is going and what we have to do, yet they want to double the amount of flying that's happening. Now, there are so many aspects of the industry that I could bore you with, but I've decided to just pick out two and go into those in a little bit of detail, rather than not do justice to anything. So the first and most obvious one is Heathrow Airport. Hopefully you'll know, have heard all about the struggles to either have or to oppose the third runway at Heathrow. I don't know if you know what that means in terms of flights, though. It means that out in and out of West London, you have an extra 260,000 flights a year, and that amounts to about 70 per hour, so better than one a minute. Yeah. So that's the amount of additional flying that they want to have in and out of Heathrow. It's basically about 50% of the current capacity. In fact, it's about more than 50%. The result of that, there are four main environmental impacts. One is the bulldozing of local communities, you know, lovely villages in West London like Harmondsworth, which would have to be razed to the ground to concrete over for runways, and long-lived communities destroyed. Second one is noise, constant exposure to intermittent noise. Well, it wouldn't be that intermittent. In fact, an extra 70 flights an hour, I think it's estimated that an extra 2.2 million people would be affected by noise who weren't previously if there was a third runway. And it's not just the nuisance of noise, it's also the fact that there aren't medical conditions associated with that exposure as well. They've been proven by studies. There's air quality, and I can't say enough about the absolute tragedy of 40,000 premature deaths in the UK per year attributable to poor air quality. And if you look at a heat map of the UK, you will see that the worst hotspot for air quality is central London, and then there's a little satellite spot just over West London, just where Heathrow Airport is. And that, so those are the worst places in the UK, and therefore one of the worst places in Europe for air quality and the effects that has on the local communities. And of course, once you get past those, you've still got the climate impact and all the things that we talked about in terms of the impacts on weather, carbon emissions, other greenhouse gases that are emitted by aircraft. Now, Heathrow and its supporters will claim that those impacts are going to be mitigated by various measures that they're taking. Now, there are certain technical improvements they want to do, like improving the fuel efficiency of aircraft, changing the types of fuels, and having better routings and things like that. And, I mean, yes, by all means, we need to do those things to make flying better than it is today. But if you think that those things will do anything other than just take a little edge off the amount of climate impacts that flying will have, then you're seriously deluded, because the basic impact of an additional 260,000 flights far outweighs what you could do with those things. The other claim by the airport is that well, things would be okay in terms of meeting our Paris climate targets because other areas of the economy will reduce to compensate for the expansion at Heathrow. I know you're laughing already, it is funny. Essentially, what would happen is that in 2050, when we've got, let's say that the UK meets the amount of emissions it should do in order to come in under the Paris climate target. If Heathrow expands by the amount that it says it wants to expand, that would account for 80% of the emissions in the UK. So, in other words, the remainder of the economy would only be able to emit 20%. I know it may be a good thing that they're only emitting that amount, but nevertheless, it seems incredibly unrealistic. And relying on the other parts of the economy would be saying, well, that'll solve the problem. It's just nonsense. I mean, there is also the issue, and I relate this to the fracking debate, is that so those unions who are behind fossil fuel expansion, including fracking, really need to think, well, if we can only do that amount because of Heathrow, what's going to happen to all those jobs that we're currently saying are going to emerge in terms of fracking? Or if you do the fracking, the jobs at Heathrow, you can't have both. You can have one or the other, preferably neither, but you certainly can't have both. So there is a challenge there in terms, for us as unions, in terms of jobs and where those jobs sit and what kinds of jobs they are. Now, once you get past all that, Heathrow will tell you, well, don't even worry about that, because we are going to be okay, because we have a plan for getting emissions down in aviation across Europe. It's called the ICAO CORSIA plan. ICAO is the International Civil Aviation Organization, global organization for the management of aviation. And CORSIA is called, if I remember, Carbon Offsetting and Reduction Scheme for International Aviation. I think its failure is built into its name, actually. It's the attempt of the industry to self-regulate and self-justify itself and to kind of give itself a green badge in terms of environmental credentials while not actually doing anything. It's actually, their claim is that they will produce carbon neutral growth in the industry. So basically that doubling with no additional carbon emissions. I mean, just incredulous, really. Now, that scheme has taken some heavy criticism because it's, apart from anything else, it's taken 10 years to negotiate and still being delayed because of industry prevarication. The idea of offsetting itself is discredited as weak criteria, ineffective, no credible mechanism for enforcement, and the offsets themselves can displace people in developing countries. It's opposed by civil groups across the globe. The other thing is that scheme, if the aviation industry, if you ever read this in the paper, they say, well, we are going to be using alternative fuels. The alternative fuels they're talking about are biofuels. All the problems with monoculture plantations that produces palm oil, deforestation, biodiversity loss, pollution of fresh water, all those things. But under the Corsia scheme, that counts towards their contribution towards the Paris climate targets. They also say, and this does make me laugh, is that if you produce fossil fuels in a plant or a refinery where it's powered by wood, then you're also exempted, so that doesn't count either, which I'm still struggling to get my head around myself. These schemes are so bad that even Virgin Atlantic has pulled out because it's sceptical about the climate impacts or the benefits of doing that. Now, I'm no expert on the ins and outs of those things, but I do recommend that if you're interested, and there is some interesting material out there, the Airport Watch or the Biofuel Watch websites are really good sources for information about those things. For me, it's a miracle in showing how far you can stretch a fig leaf, basically. So in terms of solutions, I mean, our plans are kind of embryonic at the moment, but with hopefully the imminence of a Labour government, you know, we might like to see this carried into fruition. We need to get over the competitive silos of transport, our transport infrastructure. That is, it broken up between the different modes of transport, within the modes of transport. They're all in competition with each other. The airlines are in competition with each other. Airports are in competition with each other. Even talk about different terminals at Heathrow competing against each other. You can imagine the kind of wasteful flying that produces if people going to trying to outdo each other to go to the most popular destinations. I mean, surely you need a public service ethos about the fact that flying, no less than being on the buses or the trains, is about public service, travel for the public. It's not just about profit making, but also that those things need to be joined up and coordinated to reduce the climate impact, so that you can encourage people onto better forms of transport and minimise flying as far as possible. Although actually within that, I don't know if you know this statistic, but in fact, you know, you wonder about the whole business of expanding aviation, because at the moment it's been shown that 70% of flying is done by the top 15% of the population, and 50% of the population actually in any given year don't fly at all. So there is plenty of scope for reducing the amount of flying, but I'd say there's also the scope for democratising it by spreading it around the UK a bit more. You can imagine, if you added a third runway at Heathrow, that 70% by 15% would probably intensify further and be concentrated further. In a few years' time, you might be talking about about 80% of flights, about the top 10% of the population, and so on. Actually, what you could do is reduce aviation overall, reduce the amount of flying overall, not build a runway, but actually have a little bit of growth at regional airports so that those people can actually feel the benefit of being able to fly, even though you're flying less in the UK overall. So there is a plan there. We've also got things like shifting jobs across to other forms of transport, and if we do it in a coordinated way, then people won't feel that their jobs are under threat. And it's the same thing with fuels. You know, those people in polluting fuel industries, we need to actually have a just transition for those people so they can see that it's not the end of the road for them. Their jobs, it's from this job to this job, and actually this job is much better. Not both in terms of the environment and in terms of rights, protections, pay, etc. That's what we want to do. What else do I want to say? There's also associated issues, I think, about planning of our cities and our countryside, and what we do, and food sourcing, and how much freight we want to carry, and things like that, and how far. All those things, if we have a government that has the will to do it, we can actually help to bring about. For us as unions, there are jobs in that. I mean, I'd like to turn inside out the old no jobs on a dead planet saying. I think it's a bit too negative. We need to turn it down the other way and say it takes more jobs to make a living planet than a dead one. Mm-hmm. And that's true. And those people that are in those jobs have then earned a lot. I always knew that would go down well. but it is true. The amount of work we have to do. See, I do. I will only be 1 minute, Tom. But the point about basic income, I don't disagree with you that it has a place, but I think there's a lot of work, good work, positive work to be done, and that we could set people to work on before we got to the point of thinking about that. Okay, so I'm going to end there. I just want to say, because I haven't been able to cover it in time, and I've never covered it in time, the global struggle against airport expansion is really hot at the moment. I absolutely recommend that you look up a couple of websites, Stay Grounded and the Global Anti-Aerotropolis Movement. It's a grandiose name, I know. But those two websites have loads of great information about worldwide struggles against global airport expansion and about climate justice.
Can you
and well worth looking.
The second one again?
The second one, yeah. It's the Global Anti-Aerotropolis Movement. And by aerotropolis, what they mean is not just an airport, but all the shops and car parks and stuff that go with it. So that's what that's about. Okay, so I think I've said enough, but thank you for your time. I really appreciate you listening. Thanks very much.
The seats at the front, folks.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. There's a few seats around here for those that have been standing on the side. My name's Lou, and I'm here from Preston New Road, where Codrilla are about to conduct the second frack, or the second high-volume hydraulic fracturing in the UK. The first one was at Priest Hall, and resulted in the earthquakes that caused the moratorium on hydraulic fracturing. Climate crisis and hydraulic fracturing. There's no doubt we've seen this summer the extent of the change in our climate. Over 700 people died in this country due to the heat. But when they talk about hydraulic fracturing and the extraction of gas, they tell us it's a green energy. It's a lie. It's not green at all. When they talk about extracting the gas from hydraulic fracturing in the shale, what they don't factor in into any of these equations is the building of the compounds, the drilling of the wells, the burning or cold venting of the waste gas that is collected during the exploratory stage when they're doing the flow tests. At West Newton, the little town, little village where I lived, Rathlin Energy drilled 3,300 metres into the Boland Shale, and they conducted a mini frack that went disastrously wrong. The waste gas they collected when they were doing the mini frack was cold vented to the atmosphere, and it should have been burned. If you burn the gas, it's 20% less contributing to climate change than if you cold vent it. So 80% more contribution from cold venting than burning. They didn't test the gas. The gas was tried to be, air emissions was tried to be collected in a Tedler bag, which the Environment Agency said was useless. So we didn't know what was in the gas they cold vented to the atmosphere. Now this happened in a little village near Hull. It's not in Australia, it's not in America, it's not in Africa, it's here in our backyards. People have been ill. We've now had cases of Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is the most common cause of cancer around fracking sites, or the most common cancer found around fracking sites. And one of the big things in this green energy that they're telling us is going to revolutionise our lives and reduce gas bills, it's a lie. Again, the whole thing is a Ponzi scheme built on lies. Public Health England never do base healthline checks where they're going to frack. So we have no proof of these people's ill health. The air was not tested so we don't know what was in those emissions when it was cold vented. So the people that are being ill are told there's no proof that you're ill. And this is the same story we hear from all over the world. You cannot prove what they are doing because they never conduct the baseline tests. And this is a really serious issue. Also included in their green energy is none of the vehicle movements that are bringing the chemicals and the other things down our country lanes. I will tell you that some of those convoys that came into West Newton were over 30 vehicles long down the tiniest little lanes you've ever seen. Our villages were at a standstill for 8 hours a day. There was a policeman based outside everybody's house and nobody was allowed to come or go. These are the things you never hear about. They also don't factor in the chemical spillages. There was two chemical spillages in the village of Ellaby that were covered up. They don't factor in the cleaning of the wastewater, the treatment of the wastewater. None of these vehicle movements are ever factored in. So it's not a green energy. It's a very, very destructive way of extracting gas. And what we find is the same things are happening in everywhere they want to drill. So Quadrilla's site at Preston New Road, I can only call it a major disaster waiting to happen. There's huge problems. They punctured the artesian well. The water from the artesian well is pouring onto that compound. They're moving vehicles, sometimes 8 tankers a day, to take away the surface water. But it's all right, because the government have given the green light for 2 hydraulic fractures. These companies are also held in negative equity. And the reason they're held in negative equity is if there's an environmental spill, they will liquidate them. And it's left to us to do the clean-up. And this is the tragedy. We don't need this gas. If they had invested the over £300 million they've so far spent on exploratory drilling, think what they could have done for our communities. Think about the renewable energy, the community sustainable energy programs they could have put in. But that's not going to happen because there's no money in it. Make no mistake, hydraulic fracturing is not about reducing your gas bills. It's not about bringing around a cleaner, greener energy. It's only one thing and one thing only, to make vast amounts of money for the very few at the expense of us all. Climate crisis is real and it's happening. Hydraulic fracturing in the extraction of shale gas is not going to help us. It's going to add continually to the climate change. We need to stop this, and we need to stop it now. There has to be a total ban on all onshore drilling. And the reason I say all onshore drilling, because when we talk about hydraulic fracturing, and we go back to the 2015 Infrastructure Act that was brought in by a Conservative government, to my mind, Cameron illegally defined hydraulic fracturing. Because what they've done is they defined it as high-volume hydraulic fracturing. So anything under Cameron's definition is no longer classed as hydraulic fracturing. Now, add into the mix the fact that Theresa May, in her Dash for Gas, is now bringing in the removal of the planning development requirement for anything that isn't hydraulic fracturing. It means you've got a vast amount of drilling that can take place without any planning application. Now, West Newton, where I was, and then Rathlin did the mini frack that went so wrong, is not classed as hydraulic fracturing. It's called conventional drilling. But it's no way conventional. Down our country lanes, they bring in poisons, toxics, carcinogenics, and depleted uranium. Yeah, it's a bit of a shock, really, isn't it, that they're bringing all these chemicals that they're pumping into our ground to hydraulically fracture. During the mini-frack, H2S was released. Once again, we can't prove that because they didn't test it. But it made people ill. We made the Guardian, you know, noxious odours making residents ill. But even then, we were ignored. Nobody listens. And it's this cover-up all the time. So they will tell us that it's a gold standard in this country for extraction. It's a lie. The whole thing is a lie. The Environment Agency and the Health and Safe Executive, their hands are tied. It's a bit, the only thing I can say about the Environment Agency is, or the HSE, is a bit like buying a car. You buy a new car. You don't know what's going to go wrong with it. So you take out insurance, you've got your AA cover. Then something goes wrong and you get your car repaired. It's exactly the same with hydraulic fracturing and onshore drilling. If something goes wrong, the EA will come and look at it. But guess what? It's too late. It's far too late. The cover-ups are immense. There is no baseline testing of the water in the ponds around us. So if the well leaks and you find benzene, toluene, the BTEX in the water, do you know what they say? There was no baseline test, so you can't prove it. If you're ill, there's no baseline test, so you can't prove where where this has affected you from. And the list goes on. The environmental risk assessments are not worth the paper they're written on, because do you know how they're done? People sit at their desk and see what's being reported. So if you live in a rural area with 10 houses around where they've drilled, how many people are going to log with their council what wildlife is there? So they do a half-day walk around in a desk-based study, and guess what? That's your environmental risk assessment that is contributory towards planning. I watched West Newton become a dead zone. I watched the barn owls die. I watched them poison the wildlife. And the best thing of all is, they tell us anti-frackers, when they go there, they say, they lied. They lied. I had a piece of paper in my hand that said, well-meaning activists, pointing the finger at me there, said that we were poisoning the wildlife. This is untrue. That went in something that Rathlin called a fact and evidence-based consultation that was submitted as part of their planning permission for the well site known as West Newton B, which has subsequently been mothballed. So on one hand, I had a piece of paper saying they lied, we didn't poison the wildlife. In my other hand, I had an email from Rathlin Energy to the council saying, we are currently poisoning the wildlife. And when I pointed this out to the council, they said, oh, we don't check things like that. We leave it to the experts. And this is how the cover-up continues. It starts at the very bottom and it goes all the way to the top. And it isn't just the councils, the parish councils, the regional councils, you know, the borough councils. It then goes up, national government. And included in this cover-up is the law, the police, the judiciary. We've seen it over and over again where these things are covered up. But I will tell you, we need to stop it, and we need to stop it now before this destructive, dangerous killer of an industry goes any further. Thank you.
Still seats at the front, so everyone who's standing and who's like maybe a bit tired, please come down. Just so you know, there are sign-up sheets going around where you can sign up to hear updates from Platform, which is the organisation that I'm part of, and also Labour Energy Forum, who have organised this event. You might have seen that between This World Transformed and the actual fringes of the Labour Conference, there's only three or four events on climate. So if you want more stuff like this to be happening, then definitely sign up for updates and be part of it in the future. So if everyone's settled where they want to be, then I'll start. So hi, my name is Anna. I am going to, for a minute, try and take you to Patagonia, to Argentina, the highlands. So imagine this really, really, really flat landscape. You can see for miles and miles, and it's really high as well. This river delta is stretching across it. It's really high. The air is a little bit kind of rare. From the distance in the river deltas, you can see some orchards. People are growing pears and apples, and up here on top, on the flat top, you can see some drilling rigs. You can see some rigs, and you can see some pipes flaring gas up the top. So, what is about to possibly start happening in the UK? With fracking, that we should stop, is already happening on a much bigger scale in Patagonia. And I spent a little bit of time in this land last year. So imagine we're driving a car through this landscape down a lane, and we can see one of those rigs. It doesn't seem to be flaring any gas at the moment in the distance. As we come up, closer to it, I noticed that there's a little kind of bonfire thing beside it. And I think, well, that's a bit strange. And then it turns out that there's a little barbecue by the oil rig. And the reason there's a barbecue there is because a community called Love Campo Marite, which is an indigenous Mapuche Nation community whose land we are on, are occupying the drilling rig, stopping it from drilling. And because they were going to come and have some snacks, they gave us a barbecue. People like Love Campo Marite are fighting back. They're fighting back against the infringements on their human rights as an indigenous nation. They have a right to free, prior, informed consent under various international conventions, but that's not being respected. And this drilling rig belongs to an Argentinian company called YPF, but half an hour down the road, there are rigs belonging to Shell. Another hour down the road, there are rigs belonging to BP. And as I'll explain a little bit later, there's a £1 billion pot of money from the UK government that we fear might well go to those rigs. So, Under this land in Patagonia, there's a reserve of shale gas and oil called Vaca Muerta, which translates to dead cow. Who thought to name it that? I don't know, but there you go, dead cow. It's one of the biggest reserves of shale oil and gas in the world. It contains an estimated 50 gigatons of carbon, if I'm not mistaken. Now, there are some studies that say that amount of carbon is about 15% of the global emissions budget that we can burn if we are to have a good chance of staying within a kind of safe climate limits. So that's it. So it's a massive chunk of what we shouldn't really be burning. This land, like I mentioned, much of it belongs to the Mapuche Nation. There are also farming communities who farm mostly fruit farming, who are expressing concerns about fracking on their land, and all the kind of infrastructure needed to sort of fully exploit this reserve is also threatening many communities' lives with toxic waste sites, with silica sand mines, roads, railways, export terminals. So all of that is part of the current Argentinian government's kind of economic development strategy, and it's being pushed extremely aggressively by BP and Shell and a host of other international companies. So companies from Europe, from the US, with majority of their shareholders in these places, are pushing to frack this land. And part of the reason they're doing this is because, let's say, BP, and this is a direct quote from BP CEO, doesn't frack in the UK because that would cause them the wrong kind of attention. They think that they can go halfway across the world and do it there instead. And the UK government is backing them. So there's a pot of money called the UK Export Finance. It's a kind of separate departmental body within the UK government. It provides a subsidy in the form of financing loans, guarantees, to a variety of UK businesses, but for some reason it particularly favours oil companies around the world. And it recently announced that there is a £1 billion pot of money that it's allocating to UK business in Argentina. And when Chancellor Philip Hammond goes over to Argentina for a state visit, he has a great big meeting with UK businesses who operate in Argentina to promote this money to them. And of course, who does he invite? BP Shell. So this is what we're worried might happen. And obviously, we've got to stop it. We've got to make sure that our government doesn't back this extraction. We've got to make sure that BP and Shell know that the wrong kind of attention is going to come to them, regardless of wherever they do fracking. So in that spirit, I'm going to give a few suggestions for what people can do. It's not limited, but I'm going to give a few suggestions. Let me just open them up. So I'm assuming that lots of people in the room are Labour members, so these suggestions are based on stuff that people can do as Labour members, although there's plenty of things that you could do outside of that as well. There's a climate emergency motion going through conference in a couple of days' time. You can support that. In the exhibition area of the conference, there's a stall by BP. Don't quite know what they're going to be promoting there. But, you know, if you've got a conference pass, you can go up and have a chat with them. Or you can go up and take a little selfie with a little sign saying keep it in the ground or whatever other message you want to put. Or, you know, if you want to do something else, that's also up to you. But, you know, have a think. There's that. We're also working with some Labour MPs, including Barry Gardner, who's the international climate kind of spokesperson on the front bench at the moment, to think about how to get these subsidies taken away from oil and gas. So there will be things that in your local branches of Labour or Momentum or whatever you're a part of, you can push your local MPs to support this kind of challenge, and that would be also immensely helpful. I will move into discussion soon, and I would really encourage people to have a think about what other kinds of actions we can do to stop fossil fuel drilling, not just here, but also in other places around the world, because as Tom said at the start, this kind of drilling by mostly global north capital in the global south, that is fossil fuel colonialism, and we have to stop that.
Okay, perfect. So I think we've probably got about 20 minutes for question and discussion, and then maybe 5 minutes at the end just for like shout-outs as well, kind of relevant to the topics here. So maybe if we take kind of questions and comments in threes. Do we have a mic for questions?
Yeah. Is there someone?
So maybe take them in threes, is that okay? So I've got a hand up at the back there. One over there. I'm slightly, and yeah, one there, if that's okay for the first three.
Yeah, hi, my name's Sean. I'm from a video activist collective based in London called Real News. We actually went over to the United States for 3 months this year to see what was happening on the ground with Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. And what we found all over America was mass movements rising up who were completely ignoring Trump and getting on with making the just transition themselves as social movements. And we found really visionary stuff going on all over the place. I could go on for ages, but I'll just mention two. One, Jackson, Mississippi, was probably the most visionary thing we found. Centre of the civil rights movement in the 60s, obviously. And Jackson is 80% black, overwhelmingly working class, overwhelmingly impoverished. They have now taken control of the council, radical council, and they're building a solidarity network of work, what they call a solidarity network of workers' cooperatives, with a zero carbon, zero waste at the centre of that agenda and building like real justice. The other one I want to bring up is Richmond in California. Richmond is a Chevron town. Chevron, one of the biggest oil companies in the world, have run Richmond for 100 years. The people who live there, again, overwhelmingly working class, overwhelmingly non-white, during segregation, Jim Crow were put right next to these oil refineries, have suffered from pollution for the last 100 years, ridden with cancer, but don't get any of the jobs in those fields. But again, there's most social movements on the ground that have been fighting all this stuff. A few years ago, they decided, well, we can protest and protest, but this council are all bought off by Chevron. Every single council is bought by Chevron to do what Chevron wants. So they stood community canvas against them. Chevron responded by spending $3 million on this small local election, bought up every billboard in the city, bought up all the advertising space, pummeled people with propaganda, lost every single seat to the community. They put curbs on Chevron's pollution. They forced Chevron to put some of their land over to building the biggest solar farm in the whole of the states. And they've also passed a living wage for everybody, rent controls, like load of anti-austerity cuts that come out of the demands of the social movement. These both cities, by the way, this is all pushed by people's assemblies on the ground that are putting pressure on the councils to keep doing what they should be doing. What they found now is that the state government, Jerry Brown's so-called liberal California government, who are supposedly sticking to the climate agreement, saying, no, you can't have that pollution control because it goes against what we're doing with Chevron. And what they're doing with Chevron is a cap-and-trade system. That's how they're saying they're staying within the Paris Agreement. What that is actually doing is raising emissions. So what they're doing now is they can stand people in the state against Jerry Brown's government. This is starting to happen all over America. If you want to see more of this stuff, Real News is going to be showing films that we made of all this stuff tomorrow in the Baltic Cinema at 3 o'clock, and we're also going to be showing stuff on the global aviation movement, which has got a lot of victories going on it as well. So there's cause for optimism, but I think the key to this is we start getting organised as assemblies on the ground and start putting pressure. We make our own transition and we make our own framework to do it.
My name's Helen, I'm from Haunty and Woodbean, Labour Party. Thanks for all the speakers, great contribution, also to the depth of our campaigning. I went a year ago to a fringe meeting also run by Labour Energy Forum at last year's Labour conference, and I was really quite inspired by speakers from unions, MPs, all different the sorts of speakers talking about making climate change and environmental issues central to Labour policy and campaigning. There was talk about the green industrial strategy, transition of jobs, and so on. And it was actually quite inspiring, and I came away very optimistic. I was also optimistic about the draft Labour manifesto, which had a lot about, again, about integrating environment into every aspect of Labour policy, not seeing it as a little kind of bourgeois fringe concern. I've been disappointed since at the progress on that. It seems to have slightly disappeared from Labour's main policy activities. John McDonnell made a very good speech at the TUC conference that was one reference, or perhaps two references, to community energy, no reference to a green industrial strategy or transition of jobs. So my question really is, all these are important issues, how do we get them again central to everything we do, integrated into everything we do. I agree totally about grassroots campaigning, but how do we get that sort of taken up by, you know, hopefully the future Labour government?
We have one question here, and then we can make you respond, and then we'll come on to another set.
Who was the person here?
Yeah.
I'm Andrew from Durham. I was just wondering what the panel thought the impacts of the meat industry were on global warming and what we should do about it.
Great. So do we have... Does anyone want to... I've got a quick thing to say, but does anyone have any responses to that?
Yeah. Hi. Sorry, I forgot your name. The lady over there, about raising it all on the agenda... We were talking about this prior to coming in here today, and I said that one of the most important things that can happen is the National Bank of Assets, where everything is renationalised. And the reason is that when Thatcher privatised the energy industries, what she did was she ensured energy poverty for generation after generation. But what she also did was remove the research and development into more sustainable forms of energy, because the emphasis was switched from a service providing to the people and the communities to how much money can we make from you all. And again, we keep coming back to this thing about money, and I think the most important thing we can do is take back the utilities, which are by nature private monopolies, back under our control, and then we can transform them.
Hi. So just also in response to the policy question, so I know less about what's going on at the national level, but I thought, given the US examples and given this question, it's worth mentioning that cities and municipalities in the UK can also do a lot towards the energy transition themselves. So let's take Preston as an example. Preston Council at the moment is doing some really, really amazing things in terms of transforming the local economy, in terms of setting up local kind of investment vehicles that can help, you know, both fight austerity and also build up local clean industry. So there are a lot of things that cities can do. One of these things is setting up local energy companies, the way that Bristol and Nottingham have done. Nottingham was is pretty successful, so a bit like those cities in the US. And actually, as far as I remember, the city that's invested the most in directly in solar farms in the UK is not actually a Labour city; it's Swindon, which I think is Conservative. So that kind of is an interesting question, why Labour cities aren't showing more ambition in that. And I think as Labour members, that's something that that people can also do quite successfully, is push your councillors, push your local councils to make that, to up that level of ambition and to actually set up things for the energy transition on a municipal level, which will then also push national politics to step up as well.
Shall I take the meat question? So the figures on the proportion of global emissions from meat production and consumption are hard to say with certainty. And that's partly because you've got the land that the animals are on, and how far back in time do you go where you count the carbon emissions from that land of the forest it was previously. You have also questions about the feed and how far down the line in terms of the feed about the land that was grown on, and about the fossil fuels included in the production of that feed for the animals. You've also got the fertiliser that either went into the feed or into the land, which is associated with another powerful greenhouse gas, nitrous oxide emissions, and is a huge demand. So we spend about 3% of all human energy use is to produce fertiliser for crops. It's incredibly demanding, and has also transformed the global nitrogen cycle, which is kind of under-recognised, to such an extent that the nearest comparison is 2.5 billion years ago. So in terms of what humans are doing to the planet, changing the nitrogen cycle has been even bigger than changing the carbon cycle in terms of climate change. Then you have the actual cows and the methane from the cows. And all those things together, and it's, so some people get very high figures by trying to fudge it to get really high figures. It's probably around 15 to 20% of all global emissions. And it also depends on how long a timeline you're interested in, because the methane doesn't last as long in the atmosphere as the carbon dioxide. But it is, on an individual level, cutting out meat and dairy is one of the biggest things you can do personally to reduce your climate change impacts. The other is not flying, as a kind of two really big things. But I think it's dangerous to just say, yeah, everyone should go vegetarian, because collective action is what's required to get emissions down to zero. You know, I'm a vegetarian. But the biggest impact, when I look back on my life, the biggest positive impact I've had on climate change has been part of a campaign to shut down King's North Power Station and stopping a new power station being built in 2009. And at that time, there was a proposal for 8 new coal-fired power stations, which we will be living with now. Apart from there was a massive campaign running from, you know, the Royal Society of Scientists, all the way through to like grassroots activists and everyone in between, saying to the government, hang on a minute, that is completely insane. And the argument that the industry came up with, which was a bit like the fracking arguments, is that they said, don't worry, we'll put carbon capture and storage on these power stations by the 2020s. So we'll build them and then we'll develop the carbon capture and storage and we won't have to worry about the emissions because they'll be buried underground under the North Sea forever. And we would be sitting here now, and that wouldn't be happening, because it's not happening, and we still need to develop carbon capture and storage to deal with those emissions that we'll never mitigate down to zero. So, a big campaign to stop those 8 coal-fired power stations happening, and each one of them is about the emissions of a small country. And that, so that's the legacy that we can have, and the legacy in terms of fracking and stopping that, and campaigns to stop Heathrow expansion can be much bigger when we act collectively than we are in just our own personal, reducing our own personal emissions.
Be very, very quick, because I know other people want to say things. Just in terms of the point about John McDowell's speech at the TUC and the absence of enough green issues referred to in that, because you have to bear in mind it was at the TUC, and a lot of the unions are behind some of the industries that we're not so keen on, but not just aviation, fracking and other things. There is a job to do in bringing those unions along in terms of actually believing that climate jobs are real. I don't know at what point, from being words on paper to actually being something real, that they will actually recognise there's something that will have to happen, but at some point they will. But for the time being, that may be inhibiting the kind of comments that you would like to make at that, in that sort of forum.
So yeah, I think we've probably got time for one more round of quick questions, and then we can just do shout-outs very quickly. So there's someone at the back there, and then someone there, and someone there.
Hi, very quickly, my name is Clara Bell. I'm also from the PCS Union. I'm also from like a new network called Red Green Labour. There's a few postcards going around if you want to be more active and try to shift the Labour Party toward more climate issues. Very quickly, in terms of things that people can do as well, to supplement what Anna was saying, if you are a member of a trade union, in particular at the moment, GMB, Unite and Unison, you need to get more active in your trade union. Unite support the Israel expansion. We need to make sure that the conference policy is changed next year. GMB has been supporting fracking, but also they've been at the center of a new motion where they seek to exclude non-industrial trade unions from the discussion about just transition, and this we need to put pressure for it to change. Finally, Unison. Unison, surprisingly, hasn't got a clear policy on fracking. They are for a moratorium, but they want more research. And this year at the TUC, they actually blocked an excellent anti-fracking motion by the Bakers Union that would have led to the TUC supporting a ban of fracking, and they put an amendment into it just to about the moratorium and more research. So that's another way that it's very important that whether or not you're a Labour Party member, but if you're in a trade union, start getting active in the union. Thanks.
Hello, my name is Dave from Blackpool, Anyway, thank you. My question really is about the arms industry and the impact. It's never really talked about. You know, BAE say that they have an environmental policy, so they make their bullets lead free. So I just want to talk about that. Bit.
I would just like to ask the panel what their ideas are for a positive vision to help bring about the collective action we need against these very important challenges, because we've been working for 10 years in the Zero Carbon Britain project. We've got detailed models of what it could actually be like, but we're also seeing groups springing up, like we had the launch of Zero Carbon Lancaster and Morecambe, there's a Zero Carbon Liverpool group, focusing on that positive vision, the essential yes, can help balance the essential no that we must say. So I welcome your perspectives on how we can build that in better.
So I'll also apologise, Chair, because I have to rush off to another meeting in a minute, so if I just say a few brief comments. Thanks for that final question, because you're opening up a whole other world there, aren't you, about how we organise from grassroots right out to the government. And I think it is about, forgive me for the incredibly simplistic response in a brief time, it is about linking those things up, actually. Obviously, we've got a government that is a headless chicken at the moment and isn't going to do anything even if it wasn't. But so we definitely need that. But it's also a matter of getting the communications between grassroots and activist groups, the kind of people we've heard from today, through to bigger organisations and through to that government, getting those conversations so that we're not just taking actions in isolation, we're not just making grandiose policies from above, but those two things are actually connected, so they actually make sense, joined up and coordinated. Forgive my being simplistic about it, that's kind of my best initial response.
Just on the positive solutions and visions question, I think that's really, really important for us to think about, and I think it's really important to think about that in a local context, particularly in a local context where deindustrialization has really made communities suffer and where jobs will be at risk if high carbon industries have to and eventually stop. So if you think about communities that depend on the North Sea oil extraction and gas extraction, it's particularly important that people in those communities get to have a think and have a say on what is their kind of vision, what is their positive vision for what industry, what jobs, and what kind of community they want to live in. I think part of, so just speaking from the things that I know and have worked on, I think part of the solution in the UK has to be publicly controlled, democratic energy system where energy companies are no longer running away with the profits, but rather they're accountable to citizens and they reinvest their profits into bringing people out of fuel poverty and into transforming the energy system, building renewable energy supply. and shutting down the kind of more high carbon bits of the infrastructure. So I think that has to be part of the solution. And another part of the solution has to be rooted in solidarity with places where the UK and its capital has historically colonised and removed resources from people. So I think there has to be thinking about how our initiatives of this sort can support and share resources with countries and places where we might have taken resources away from before. So those are sort of my 2 points on that.
I guess I saw it as this kind of positive vision. If you kind of think about, you know, a day in some kind of green future where you, like, you know, get up, have your solar powered shower, zero energy shower, living in a green, well insulated, you know, comfortable home. You go to your job on clean, green public transport after dropping the kids off at school, and then you know, you come back from work and go and visit the local nature reserve, you know, and then so on. It can be a really attractive thing, but the underpinnings of that, and that's why I kind of go back to universal basic income, is that it gives people an opportunity to think about the longer term. They're not just thinking about the next pay packet and what to do today, and you can't grasp opportunities that are there. And you can't say no to really environmentally destructive labour. And if you can do those two things, then you can free people. People can be much freer. And they also have the power to say no. And that changes what the production of the economy produces. And ultimately, you know, the question that we live on this human-dominated planet is about the scale of the global economy and the scale of the UK economy and about shifting that to be much more about nurturing ourselves and nurturing other species and the wider environment than it is at the moment, which is about nurturing future profits. And these things have to be seen to be tied together to go to that vision, which is something much better than we have today.
I'd like to say two things. First of all, DICEY. It's the largest arms fair in the world, and it's held twice a year in London. Once every 2 years in London. When you go to DICEY, you can buy warships, tanks, planes. They're all there for you to see. Inside, they have these weapons of mass destruction, I suppose, which is, I hate the term. 4 years ago, Caroline Lucas went in. She was barred in 2017 from entering again because 2 years prior to that, she discovered that we were selling torture weapons under the counter. Now, there are over 30 countries that attend DICEY, including Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, all the places that you really don't want to sell arms to. So I think one of the biggest things we can do, and although it's our second largest export, is we have to stop the arms fair. We have to stop this production of weapons. And yes, of course, it's in increasing climate change and contributing to it all. And the second thing I'd like to say is about the control of energy. Kissinger once said, "He who controls the food controls the people. But he who controls the energy controls the nations." And that's what it's about. Energy supply, arms supply, all these other things. It's about controlling the people, social control. We have to fight back. And I think, community energy building programs is the way forward because we change the balance of power. The balance of power at the moment is with the government. They're controlling the court, the law system, the police, everything they can to drive forward this gas, this dash for gas through hydraulic fracturing. If we can switch the power balance, then we take control back. That has to be the way forward. Community energy programs.
So I think that's pretty much it, unless anyone very briefly has any shout-outs. I'm New Socialist, are running a reading group on eco-corbinism at 10 o'clock for the next 3 days. All the kind of materials online on the TWT website. It would be great if people could come along to that. Anyone, any shouts very quickly from the panel?
Just wanted to remind people, very important, down in Preston New Road, we have stopped a Tory government from fracking for 7 years. Preston New Road has stopped a Tory government, understand that, how important that is, for 7 years. Right now, we are bleeding. We need the country now to come down to Preston New Road and help us. This is our old right now. We've been battered by the police, there's people on that front line there. We need you now, we need the unions, we need Labour to come down and help us. We've done our bit, we need you to help us now. We're going to be in here in the corner here. If you want to help us today.